Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Welcome again to Circles of Change. We're going to shift gears here and go into the world of research, social justice, and bridging the digital divide. So with Dr. David Fetterman, based out of California. Good morning, David. How are you today?
Good morning, Zara. Good to hear from you.
Absolutely. Well, it's a real pleasure. Let me introduce David quickly, and then we'll get into our topic. He's president and CEO of Fetterman & Associates, which is an international evaluation consulting firm. He's a graduate of Stanford University, as well as I am, and David continued his career there for 25 years, including serving in administrative positions, as well as the director of evaluation in the School of Education and the School of Medicine. David is now the director of the Arkansas Evaluation Center at the University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff. He's a noted scholar in his field of research and research methods, and David has thus served the American Evaluation Association as its president prior, and he's also thus received the highest honors in theory and practice. And our topic today is going to be David's book, Empowerment Evaluations in the Digital Villages. It's about a $15 million community change initiative that was designed to bridge the digital divide in East Palo Alto, California, East Baltimore, and San Diego. And this large-scale journey is as much about a race towards enabling social justice as it is the characterization of this impact of technology in all of our shifting world. And really, it involved in a partnership between Hewlett Packard Company, Stanford, and then three ethnically diverse communities. And the end result, as you're going to hear about today, has been really enabling some constituencies to really build their own technology-oriented businesses, improve their education system, and also improve their economic health. So congratulations. What an opportunity to write a book on a project that you've been so intimately involved in, David.
It was fun, definitely engaging. I can't say it all was uphill. There was definitely some detours I'll tell you about as well, but overall, very successful enterprise, no question about
That's great. Well, perhaps to kind of get some terminology based, which good academics know they always have to start with, right, is could you explain what empowerment evaluation is? What is that?
Yeah, it's basically evaluation that people do of assessing whether it's a car or a house or business, but it turns it upside down. That's the only thing different about it. Instead of me being in charge as the expert, the people I work with in the community are the expert. And I'm the coach or critical friend or assistant who helps them keep it rigorous, keep it on track and meaningful, and helps them use evaluation not just as an end to, well, you did well, you didn't do so well, but how do you use that to get to where you want to go, meeting your objectives? So empowerment evaluation is really helping people learn to evaluate their own performance in social programs and organizations, in corporations and hospitals and schools, to help them get to that goal where they want to go. That's what empowerment evaluation is all about.
And that makes so much more sense, because you're actually giving people the tools and guiding them through a process so they can own the outcome, as opposed to many evaluations that are done that make it feel like they're being tested and there's going to be a pass or fail or retribution to be had if you don't get the score, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. And in that case, they feel like evaluation has been done to them.
By them, exactly. Well, one of the techniques I know that you use that perhaps some of our listeners aren't familiar with, although they probably do it in their own day-to-day life, it's the word ethnography. So could you explain and unpack that one, as we'd say?
Yeah, I have a whole book on that, believe it or not, as well, and you never believe it. A term as esoteric sounding as that for most folks actually is a bestseller in academic world. It's in 13 or 14th printing. But it's a very simple approach. All it really is, it's a tool in anthropology, of all things, that helps you get at the insider's view of reality. So when you go into an organization, instead of just imposing your assumptions and views of what's going on, you ask people what they think from their view of reality. And let me give you an example of why this is so important, because some people will automatically go, oh, wait a minute, David, isn't the external objective view the most important? People delude themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the point. The point is, if that's what their perception is of behavior, that's what's going to shape the behavior.
Right.
A quick example is, I was in a VA hospital where I was doing an evaluation, and these men thought they could fly. I mean, like, not like on an airplane flight, I mean, like, fly or go right out there themselves. Now, I don't happen to believe that. You don't happen to believe they can do it. But there are real-world concrete consequences for that perception of behavior or reality if they're on the third floor of a building with no bars on the window.
Mm-hmm.
So the perception of reality is just as important as reality as far as predicting future behavior. That's one of the reasons ethnography is critical. And as we had a chance to speak earlier about, Intel and other corporations, not just academic institutions, are hiring ethnographers because they get past just what is statistically significant into what, the why. Why are people operating a certain way? And then they can anticipate where things need to, where they're going to go.
And so a good part of ethnography involves the skill of observation.
Yeah. It's basically, the key is really observing what's going on with a lens of being, trying to be, anyway, as non-judgmental as you can about that view. And then, of course, interviewing as well to see not only what you saw, but to see it, to triangulate, to compare that with different sources to see, is that what I think I saw based on what they actually say about it? And it's important to do because I remember looking at a school for dropouts many years ago, and I used to be a high school teacher before a professor, being a professor, and my mom was a high school teacher before a professor, so I know what it is like to be a high school teacher. And I went in there after school, and the teachers were making collages for the kids and that sort of thing, and I'm thinking, oh, this is wonderful. They're so dedicated and everything else. And then, and so my observation is, what a dedicated group, and everything is wonderful, but it's important to check and ask. So I ask, what's going on? Isn't this wonderful? You do all these collages? Do you use, you know, such and such material? And they say, this is terrible. We were supposed to have the money for the resources to buy these posters, and instead they held the money back. So in other words, if I hadn't asked and gotten their view of reality, I would have made assumptions that would have been incorrect. Even though I was based on a lot of years of experience, I would have been wrong had I not at least checked to get the insider's view of reality. That's why ethnography is so critical.
It is. So let's take that those two terms then, an empowerment evaluation and ethnography. Now take us on this journey of this change initiative to help East Palo Alto, East Baltimore, and San Diego course correct or go in a different place.
Yeah, it's interesting. Starting with one of the groups was about 18, 19 tribes in San Diego, Native Americans, and they normally don't get along that well. They have a lot of baggage over the years and stuff like that. So what we asked them is, you know, what would you be interested in working on that's technologically oriented in some fashion? And we do this in many communities, by the way, where we go, are you interested in education? Because it's very poor. And they go, we'll get folks from different backgrounds saying yes. Same thing in security, and maybe not in housing. So we don't work on the ones that they don't have a common bond or interest in.
Right,
so we look for the common. But yeah, we look at that, exactly that core, and we work with that. Because you can't win on all topics and that sort of thing. But you get momentum in that area. So what they did is they wanted to get connected with the rest of the world, because the old Bureau of Indian Affairs, BIA, was responsible for segregating them on the reservation. And them so that they're all separated, couldn't communicate with each other, even on the reservation, never mind outside. And, you know, people aren't familiar with that. That's also where they used to take their kids away because they didn't want them to learn the languages and, you know, all that sort of thing. That's turned around, obviously, quite a bit now. And this was a chance also to leapfrog past the old view of what digital media and digital connections were to the modern world. So in their case, what they did, and they weren't crazy about computers when we started, they built, according to the head of the FCC at the time, one of the largest wireless systems in the country.
Wow.
They built the towers, they got the routers, they got the kids learning how to do Cisco routing, that sort of thing. They got into it, they sold some of the bandwidth, so they're making money, entrepreneurial. They built the digital printing press. They had all sorts of wonderful outcomes. I'm not saying it was a straight line, we started here and everything was beautiful. A lot of mistakes, a lot of miscommunication, et cetera, and that's why you have empowerment evaluation where they're constantly assessing how well are we communicating? How well are we actually producing what we want to produce? Are we actually getting to the goal of building the bandwidth to connect? And one of the pictures in my book, Empowerment Evaluation in the Digital Villages, really hit home with HP, with Hewlett Packard. And I took a lot of pictures to document what we're doing. But this one is a picture, if you probably remember seeing it in the book.
Yes.
It's with me in my class at Stanford, video conferencing with the Native Americans in San Diego in the Tribal Digital Village. The reason HP loved it is that was worth the $15 million because that had face validity. They could see the outcomes were reached. They actually were able to not only communicate within the reservation using internet, but outside the reservation, and not only anywhere outside, but to Stanford, which HP loves Stanford because you came from Stanford.
Back down, of course, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so you got the automatic beautiful connection. So they had marvelous outcomes. I mean, not a straight line because you probably remember HP, remember in those days also early, they acquired Compaq at
Absolutely.
One point.
So there was a lot of corporate distress going on at the same time this was going on.
Big mess. And the problem is, here's where some people can blame the victim. If you only looked at the sites at that time, you could have said, wait a minute, why aren't these folks distributing a lot of the computers to some of the families, like the promise, and the community members? And your first reaction is, if you would evaluate it poorly, on a superficial level, you'd go, oh, the tribal digital village at that stage was doing terrible. If you study up, like Lord Nader talks about, then you start saying, wait a second, Compaq and HP have just, they've had a merger, took it over Compaq, and they're having terrible problems with the delivery in general throughout the United States and internationally. This was just a byproduct of that as well. So it would have been blaming the victim if we blamed the site for it until we rectified that and notified them that, you know what, this is a ripple effect from the larger corporate problems and issues, and then they were able to straighten it out. So it's a lot of bumps in the road. I don't want to make it ever sound smooth. And sometimes not their fault. Sometimes it was their communication problems. But when there were problems, we tackled them and addressed them directly and openly. And not, I'm not saying comfortably. It felt into little bins. You know, talk about this topic and you are.
But the other thing you said that was so important is to get people to study up or look up or keep raising to a higher cause and to get these 18 or 19 tribes that otherwise deeper down in the nitinoids would be critiquing and criticizing one another or just doing it in a different way. But you had a common goal in this case, which was to enable their connectivity amongst themselves but also with the outside world. Well, now take us to the other side of the country of what went on then in East Baltimore.
That was interesting. That's literally the opposite side of the story for the book and for our experience. They luckily, I'll give away the ending. They did succeed at the end, but let's put it this way. For folks listening that have done this kind of work, consulting in some fashion and working with different corporations, they'll really appreciate how much of a misstep this one was. The site, the Baltimore Digital Village, was moving along. They're trying to, their mission is to try to distribute a lot of these computers, laptops to teachers and the public school system and to families. And they couldn't get off the dime. They wasn't getting over there to anyone. They were barely even getting out of the shipping, you know, yard. It was like, it was just a mess. And on top of that, HP wanted to come by for a site visit, which is, of course, a normal thing to do for someone who has given the whole program $15 million.
Sure.
I think that's a reasonable request. And get this. The Baltimore Digital Village snubbed them and turned them away and said, you are uninvited. Now, anyone who's ever done this kind of work is going, this is probably not the smartest
thing
move
to do. Right.
Yeah. So now HP, to their credit, very impressive, still wrong, but impressive, said, you know, we understand. They don't think they're ready yet, so they don't want to waste our time.
So we'll step back.
It was a mistake because the reality is, so wherever you are is wherever you are. If you're not doing well, maybe that's what you need, more assistance and more scrutiny, and that's the time actually to come and do a site visit. So in retrospect, the humility, which HP has a lot of humility, people don't realize, and a lot of respect for the process, made a misstep by being almost too careful in that regard. The reason I say that is because then the site, the Baltimore Digital Village, started to develop sort of an organizational arrogance.
You bet.
When HP had, you know, some other expert to come by, you know, Anderson or Deloitte, too, some folks, high-end folks consulting stuff that could help them with their business, they turned them away. Phenomenal resources. And over time, they started, you know, shooting themselves in the toes by turning away these great resources because they thought that, you know, they knew best. Well, they know best about their mission and goal, but not necessarily how to get there.
David, you know, I have to imagine, as our listeners think about this, whether this was a characterization of a not-for-profit, wonderful endeavor to help stem, you know, a change initiative inside a community. You just change the names and the faces, and I could tell you countless opportunities and organizations I've been in that have manifested these very same attributes. Yep. So this idea of empowerment evaluation is so important, but it doesn't mean the word empowerment necessarily totally reigns free from the experts that should be vested in the outcome. So then take us to near and dear to your heart, because East Palo Alto, of course, very close to Stanford University, where you spent so many years. What was going on in the context of this evaluation there?
That was cool. That was similar to Baltimore in that they were introducing it to the school system and to teachers and parents and that sort of thing. And the idea, which is similar to Baltimore eventually, but they picked up on it much quicker, was by introducing the laptops to teachers, it wasn't just to educate teachers and to give them to the kids, but to transform the curriculum and make it internet safe. That was the very smooth approach in that regard that was very powerful and turned the curriculum around, because they weren't text-based as much, which doesn't sound like a big deal, but when you don't have any money...
Money, exactly.
...impoverished, they suddenly had the world around, as far as resources, and they didn't even have a clue before that.
Mm-hmm.
It also had a ripple effect of helping the families, because the parents are supposed to help the kids with their homework using the internet. Well, they started using them also to look for jobs.
Jobs,
to
exactly.
Look for other educational activities and opportunities. So the ripple effect was phenomenal in transforming the curriculum for the school district and also for the community in terms of what they suddenly saw was out there in the world for them to benefit from, the adults, parents, not just the kids. It was just a segue into the community, and then they became literally dependent on that as a resource, free resource, to be able to access all sorts of things, including healthcare as well.
Exactly.
So
right.
That was a phenomenal transformation.
Well, great. For those of you who may have just tuned in, we're speaking with Dr. David Fetterman. He's based in California, and his newest book is called Empowerment Evaluations in the Digital Villages. And we're talking about some fascinating work that had been done in three different communities. David, tell me, you know, again, your whole field of study, work, and so on, consulting, has been in this idea of empowerment evaluations. How were these three, or this major initiative, different than some of the other global ones you've taken on over time? What were some of your own personal, wow, I didn't expect that to come at me?
Almost all of it, good and bad, to be honest with you, because what happens when you, I've done a lot of traditional evaluation where I'm the expert and I'm in charge, and I've done work everywhere in Japan, Brazil, I do a lot of work in South Africa, et cetera. We do empowerment evaluations there as well. But when you do traditional evaluation, you're pretty much the expert, and you pretty much have the say of where things are and where they are and where they should go. And that's okay, and you've left literally nothing behind.
Mm-hmm. That's the key.
And at certain point you sort of mature and realize, you know, if I'm doing all this work and I'm getting awards, I'm not, you know, ashamed of it. I think it's great, and I think 14 books or whatever. But some of the times my impact is in nanoseconds, as far as policy impact. And that's maybe when you start out, that sounds great, but it's meaningless. You want to build capacity. That's what this is all about.
Yeah.
It's leaving behind the ability for people and communities and organizations to become organizational learning experts of their own and actually develop a tool that they can use forever by self-assessing where they are. Like in Arkansas, I have a tobacco prevention program over there. We work throughout the whole state. And I work with local communities. There are churches, nonprofits, hospitals, you name it. And they're using empowerment evaluation as well. And they're establishing their own goals. They're coming up with benchmarks about what percentage should they be in terms of people not smoking at each part of the year. And then they also have their actual performance. So they can actually say, I got to have maybe smoke-free parks. I want 10 in a year. I have zero the first quarter. I better get moving. And then what do you do about that? Well, you start talking to colleagues who've been successful at
exactly.
that.
Exactly. You see the ripple effect. Isn't that true?
Yeah. And then you start talking to us as evaluators who also know about that topic, and then the CDC. And what happens is instead of people, you know, shying away and running away from evaluation, they run towards it and giving you a hug, basically, because it's a question of how can you now assist me to get to where I need to go? And they help each other. So it becomes a collaborative kind of learning organization kind of experience rather than a constant game playing. And most of us are used to being corporations, and we play the game and make the numbers look good so that we look good and get whatever bonus or whatever, you know. And it doesn't bring the organization anywhere, and it doesn't help the client.
Well, then the classic one of that, of course, is the classic case of how many employee surveys are done. And we wonder, gee, that now maybe the unintended consequences are greater than the intended, which means if we don't do anything with the data that we collect, that it makes it doubly bad. And in fact, I recall countless times when asked, the employees are asked the question, so what's your biggest concern about the survey? And they, number one is that management won't do anything with what I tell them. And so that's nothing harder to you know, swallow at that point in time. Well, David, your book has been out for a reasonable amount of time, I'd say, at this point. What kind of reactions have you been getting to it out there in the world beyond?
It's amazing. You know, for an academic book, I mean, I did write it with a racing motif, so maybe that helped. I don't know. Now I quote, it's not your typical academic book. I do quote Mario Andretti. In some chapters, I have one that says, if everything seems under control, you're just not going fast enough.
In fact, that's my favorite quote, by the way. My quote. If you're under control, you're not going fast enough. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and it's true. You know that. An organization.
Absolutely.
They go at fatal speed. So if you're sitting there, you know, and it's similar to this other one. It says, if you wait, all that happens is that you get older.
That's right.
I love it. And, you know, not to be reckless, but the reality is, you know, no one can wait. People have disenfranchised communities. People not even disenfranchised that just aren't going anywhere in their organization and see the same sort of dysfunctional organization operating that they live in, and they want to, this becomes a window of opportunity for them to break through that and change and have a more productive feeling and satisfaction for their life and their trajectory. So it's all of these have had sort of aha moments, but I guess the key answer to your question is they've all been sort of an aha that I have to change as an evaluator and as a colleague and a consultant as much as they're changing. I mean, one very quick example.
Yeah.
I was in I work in townships in South Africa as well on squatter settlements. And I'm helping them work on self-sustaining agriculture, little garden plots and that sort of thing. And I know very, very little, but a tiny bit about agriculture because my mom worked in a land-grant university, so I know I picked up a tiny bit. I'm not an expert by a long shot. But they're starting to talk about, you know, where they should have and where the sun should come and what, you know, what shading and what kind of crops you should have in there for their garden so they have some sustainability. Because, you know, they don't have electricity, they don't have running water most of the time, but, you know, they're starting to be self-sufficient with these empowerment projects on food, basically. And I go to get up out of my chair and go, oh, you know, you might want to, and they go, oh, David, no, that's okay. We don't need that. We've got that covered. Now, the old me as an evaluator coming thousands of miles to South Africa in a township would have been, how insulting. I'm from Stanford. I got a PhD. I got two MAs. I've got two bachelor's.
And I've got 20 years of experience on projects like this all over the world, but.
Yeah, exactly. But the new me as an empowerment evaluator goes, fantastic. They don't need me the same way anymore. That's what I'm looking for. I'm looking to work myself out of a job.
Yep. In fact, I would say, I really want to re-quote you if I could, that as a consultant or an evaluator, you have to be willing to change with your clients. And what you're saying here is, by the way, already be prepared for an exit strategy, whether you dictate it or they do. But the good news, if they do because you've empowered them, that was the reason for your being there in the first place.
That's right. You got it. You got it. And that's what I think some folks forget. Is that the whole idea, you know, not to parallel with kids, but the same concept of you don't want them dependent on you forever, right?
Oh, I was going to say, here comes the parenting lesson for all of us parents that are saying, yep, we're supposed to be happy that our child no longer comes and asks us for advice.
They ain't calling us. Yeah, we complain. How come they're not calling us anymore, or even these days, texting us enough, you know? What's the deal? Well, but that's what we're aiming for, and we forget that part of it. And the whole concept is, so, for example, when I do some of the workshops to facilitate the process in the tribal digital village, going back over there for a second, I'll typically lead it, but I'll have someone from the community who's very interested or even has some experience in an evaluation work with me. And then the second time, I'll probably have them lead it. I'll still be there. I don't abdicate my responsibility, just let them go and do whatever they want. And by the third time, I step even further away and further so that they're taking more and more of in charge of it, and they see themselves as in control, then you're building their capacity. It doesn't mean you don't jump in when you have to. It doesn't mean you operate just any and do anything like you were mentioning earlier. It's not in a vacuum. It's within the context of what people have to do anyway. But within that context, there are many things that they know how to do that are going to be more effective than what they're told to do that's not related to their actual capacity or
And in fact, as you know, you might have thought you went in to go fix item A, but really MN and Q were much more higher value and, oh, by the way, had to be done first before you could get to A anyways.
That's right.
David, thank you so much for our listeners. I really commend this book to you. It's called The Empowerment Evaluation in the Digital Villages. If anything, you'll acquire a tremendous amount of empathy for communities that are truly not as advantaged as others are around our country, but even at that, how people rising up on their own with the right facilitators and tools can do that. You can learn more about David's other work at David Fetterman, FETTERMAN.com. David, thanks so much for joining us. And have you got the passport ready? Is there another global project underway?
Yeah, we're already doing work with the Kellogg Foundation and helping them move forward with dashboards so people can see quickly where they are in relation to their goals in a visual way. But whole community initiatives is what I focus on and help people move forward with.
That's exactly right. And as you say, the ripple effect, then it flips right back into the homes that people can take these technologies or different mindsets and really impact their families and their friends and the community from a different vantage point as well. Wonderful. Thank you so much. Enjoy the balance of your vacation. I appreciate you taking some time out to join us here on Circles of Change.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
You bet. My pleasure. Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.